In this part of Focus, we will be continuing with an occasional series that we have been doing roughly once a month now, since going back to last fall, looking at various aspects of literacy. And we're doing this with the help and the cooperation of the folks at the National Council of Teachers of English, an organization that's based in Urbana. We have on past programs talked quite a bit about reading and writing. And this morning, the subject is something a little certainly related but different, something we haven't touched on so far, and that is spelling and how it is in school we teach children to spell or perhaps help them learn to spell. Our guest is Dr. Sandra Wild. She's done a lot of research and speaking on the issue of spelling and also phonics. She's professor of curriculum and instruction at Portland State University in Oregon and has done a lot of work in the area of invented spelling, which is, and we're going to talk a lot about this, but which is the tendency of children to make up spellings for words, sometimes novel spellings, that conform generally to how those words sound. And this is an area of some controversy, whether or not you let children do that and at what point you start to move them from a spelling that seems to serve them well enough to what is the conventional spelling. As we talk this morning, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Now, we do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if you are listening here in and around Indiana and Illinois, you can use that number if it would be a long-distance call for you. Also, if there are people listening over the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So, again, 333-WILL, which probably doesn't make it any easier, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Wild, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
I'm delighted.
In an article that you wrote, you make what seems to be for me, who is, you know, not an educator and kind of an outsider in this, a pretty dramatic statement, and that is this. You write that the changes that have taken place in how elementary school children learn to spell are among the most profound changes in literacy education in recent years. So it seems to be saying a lot.
Yes, and I think they're particularly profound because it involves such a deeper understanding of how children learn than the traditional approach, which I think probably many in your listening audience grew up with, which is where you have a spelling book and you learn 20 words a week.
Mm-hmm.
The newer research shows us that the invented spelling that children do isn't just random, it isn't just misspelling, but it's based on how they're coming to understand the language. And so they start out representing sounds, and then eventually you start to see things like they're using double letters because they've seen those in their reading. And a sophisticated teacher can actually look at a child's invented spelling and tell you something about where that child's development is in terms of how they understand language.
Mm. I think also that you make what is an interesting point, something that perhaps it would be helpful for people to keep in mind, and that is learning to spell is a developmental issue, and that we're used to the idea that children will develop certain kinds of behaviors, will be able to do certain kinds of things at certain times. We have benchmarks for those, but we also are willing to say, well, all kids are different, and we're going to be flexible about when they do certain things and when they don't. But we're accepting of the idea that for many activities and many behaviors that there's a readiness issue, but it seems that in the past we haven't approached spelling that way. We've had this idea that this you're going to learn to spell either at this age or this grade level, and you're going to do it at this rate, and we're going to do it in this way, and it didn't really seem to appreciate the fact that children, perhaps, there are indeed readiness issues about spelling.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you never got partial credit on a spelling test for really good invented spelling.
Mm-hmm.
And here's an example of the developmental nature of it. If you take the word laugh, a very beginning writer might just get the first letter, like a kid in kindergarten might just get the L. And then a kid who's getting pretty good at relating sounds and letters might spell it L-A-F. basically one letter for each sound. And then in an older kid, I've seen the spelling L-A-U-H-G. And so the kid has all the right letters, but in the wrong order. And the child has obviously seen the word in print and just doesn't have it quite right yet, but is further along than the child that spells it just phonetically.
Here, I guess maybe it's a good time to start talking, and we have a caller, and I want to get to them in a moment. So I will promise that person we're not going to make them wait forever. But here to talk a little bit about invented spelling, and I think as you say, people of our age probably grew up in the era when we did have spelling books, mm-hmm. we had spelling tests, and every week we were presented with some seemingly fairly random list of words, just isolated as themselves out in the world, and said, all right, this week you're going to learn these words, and we're going to give you a test, and next week we're going to give you a different list of words. And that was the way that we did it. Now it seems that there's much more flexibility, and perhaps it has to do with the fact that we want children to like to read and write, to be interested in those things, to have them be fun. And when it comes to writing, we're trying to get them to focus on content and on storytelling, and maybe we decided that if every week, you know, they're doing their best to tell an interesting story and they're getting into telling stories, that if they get back a paper that's marked wall to wall with red, where we say this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, that's going to turn them off. So we have some greater tolerance for the fact that at least at the beginning we're going to say, okay, let's focus on meaning and content, and we'll as we go along, we'll look at things like spelling and grammar.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And very young children, kindergarten and first grade, are doing writing now in a way they never used to. And in large part, that's because of invented spelling. They're able to write independently. Basically, once they know the names of the letters, they can start relating letters and sounds and do invented spelling. And in addition to enabling them to write, it's also, you could say it's a way that they teach themselves about phonics, because phonics is about relationships between letters and sounds, and that's exactly what they're focusing on. So it's really valuable for a number of reasons. And for young children, invented spelling isn't even controversial in the profession. The differences of opinion have more to do with how soon and how quickly you want to make the transition into standard spelling. But everybody agrees that invented spelling is excellent for beginning writers.
Well, I think that the place where we get into the controversy has to do, it's not within the teaching, not within the English teaching profession, but it has to do with parents and others looking at this and having a problem with the notion of invented spelling, and people coming out and saying, well, see, there you go again. What's happened is we've slipped, we've departed from the basics, those things that are the most important, and now teachers they've given up. They're approaching spelling as if it really didn't matter. And I think teachers are really trying to turn around and say, no, that's not it. Well, of course we believe that spelling is important. It's just the way that we're approaching it is different.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, for instance, everybody would agree that by, around the end of elementary school, around fifth grade, we would like most students, the vast majority of students, to be able to produce a piece of writing that is as close to correctly spelled as possible. And then the question is how you get there. I think the contemporary educational view is that you start out by having children write in large quantity and with invented spelling, and then you gradually move towards more correctness, rather than saying, well, you aren't allowed to write until you know how to spell the words right, because this way they're able to get the benefit of doing all that writing. And then they also learn about how to work with spelling as part of the writing process, about how to proofread your own writing, about how to find the words that you don't know how to spell, and so on.
Well, we have a caller I want to get to, and just very quickly for anyone who has tuned in the last few minutes here, I'd like to also reintroduce our guest. Sandra Wild is professor of curriculum and instruction at Portland State University in Oregon, and has done a lot of work and does a lot of speaking, particularly with teachers, on the issue of spelling and how it is children learn to spell and how teachers can help them learn to spell. Questions, of course, are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring in. First one is in Eureka, and that's on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have an inquiry about double letters. If they don't contribute anything to the word, why, is there a tendency maybe with dictionaries and things like that to go to single letters? Could you comment on double letters?
Oh, yes. Double letters are so interesting. I'm glad you asked that. The thing that makes double letters so challenging is that you don't hear two sounds, like in the word butter, B-U-T-T-E-R, you only hear one T sound. The reason that we have the double letters a lot of the time is so that it gives us information about the vowel that comes before the double letter. Like, for instance, the word hammer, the double M tells us that that's a short vowel, that that's an A sound. If it were just H-A-M-E-R, it would be pronounced hamer. And I think our spelling system, the spelling system of English, in a lot of ways doesn't seem very logical. It doesn't always directly reflect the sounds. And it's because the spelling system is doing other things other than just reflecting a single sound, things like a consonant spelling, which will tell you about the vowels that precede it. We have other spellings that are there for historical reasons. The word knife, K-N-I-F-E. Used to be pronounced something like Kanifa. The K was pronounced. The pronunciation has changed. The spelling has remained the same. And so people often think that, well, shouldn't we be moving towards a more logical spelling system? People come along regularly who say, let's try and reform the spelling system to make it more phonetic. But language just doesn't work that way. It isn't going to happen. And so I think for adults, double letters are one of the things that adults get wrong most often in spelling, not knowing if it's a double letter or not. And it's often one of those things that you just do have to check because it's not going to change anytime soon. The biggest piece of it, I think, is we do tend to just remember the spellings of many, many thousands of words, and that's why we get it right most of the time. But occasionally, we just aren't sure if a word has a double letter or not, and we do have to look it up.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call. I do think that it's a very interesting point because, as you say, often people complain about spelling because the spelling and the pronunciation don't line up. And they say, and as you say too, that over time, people have tried to introduce simplified spellings. And I think what you say is true is that over time, deliberate efforts to reform language have generally always failed.
Yes.
People just don't take well to being told. Language, of course, changes and it seems to have a mind of its own, but people don't seem to respond very well to forced efforts to get people to change. So we're confronted with spellings that when you look at them and then you hear the way they're pronounced, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I guess it is interesting and to keep in mind that there are, on some level, the spelling does make sense. There is an explanation for why it is we spell one way and perhaps pronounce another, and that may be something in the way that some of us older kids learned was never really explained to us. It was never really part of the instructional process. So, of course, we'd say, well, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. And here's a couple of examples where it doesn't seem to make sense, but it really does. If you think of the words medical and medicine, the letter C in both those words, in medical, it makes a K sound. In medicine, it makes an S sound. Now, it might seem more logical to use a K and an S in those words instead of a C, but having the C in there shows us that those words have a meaning relation. Another example is the word one. You would think it would be spelled W-U-N. In fact, that's the way a lot of young children do spell it. But the reason it's spelled O-N-E, you can see it in relationship to the word only, that one and only are spelled in a very similar way. And that reflects, like with knife, the fact that several centuries ago they were pronounced much more similarly than the spelling of one, or sorry, the pronunciation of one changed from something like ona to the present-day pronunciation of one, which doesn't seem logical, but the spelling does preserve the meaning relationship.
We're talking about the fact that perhaps the traditional way of teaching spelling was spelling with spelling lists.
Yes.
And that what that seems to suggest is that the idea was that spelling is just something that you have to memorize. It's a matter of rote, and that it doesn't really make any sense per se. It's just a matter of you just have to learn this is the way that it's spelled. Have we abandoned that, or are we still saying that in some respects it really is a matter of memorization, and you can't rationalize spelling? It's something that you just have to accept.
It really is a little bit of both. There definitely are patterns in how we spell words, and I think those are useful for children to explore. For instance, there are a lot of different ways to spell the long O sound. You see it in the word loan, L-O-A-N, and in the word loan, L-O-N-E. And I think it can be interesting to talk about with those kids and help make them more aware of it. When they're aware of those patterns, they can come up with a good invented spelling, but they may not come up with the correct spelling. For instance, you have to know which word loan you're talking about to be able to spell it right. Fortunately, a lot of the memorizing happens unconsciously through reading. The single biggest contributor to kids learning how to spell a lot of words is doing a lot of reading, and it's volume of reading that really makes a difference. If you see a word in print one time, you'll probably remember something about the spelling. If you see it in print 100 times, you're very likely to remember it. There also are differences between people in natural spelling ability. Somebody that has a lot of it is able to pick up words more readily from their reading. My quick and dirty test for natural spelling ability is if you're in a restaurant and you see one word misspelled on the menu, does it leap right out at you? If it does, then you're more likely to be the kind of person that's just aware of spelling and how to spell words and whether they're spelled right. If not, you're going to have to work a little harder at it. And I think there can be a little room for small amounts of sort of formal memorization of words, particularly common words that you miss a lot. Like one thing I hear all the time from teachers is these kids are in fourth grade and they can't spell they correctly. They spell T-H-A-Y. Which is logical, of course. That's the way it sounds. And it's actually not very hard to just say to kids, okay, this word they, you're getting wrong all the time. Wouldn't it be nice to just learn it so you don't have to proofread it the whole rest of your life? And then once you've realized, okay, this is the word I have trouble with, then you can just think of a way to remember it, because I think they're going, well, is it an E and I think it's an A, or an A and I think it's an E? And you can just say, for instance, well, I'm just going to remember that the word they is the plus a Y. And then you're always going to have something to pin it to and be able to get it right.
We have some other callers, and next person in line is in Danville, and that is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, talking about spelling, I've seen kids on the National Spelling Bee on TV, the ones that are real good out there in Washington.
Yes.
They don't spell by rote memory. They spell like they tell them the rules if that's a Latin word or a Greek word, and they're saying they're doing the equivalent to like long division. And they teach the ones here in the local area by rote memory. Like cat is C-A-T, why? Because I told you C-A-T. They're saying it's the Latin word, therefore it means that.
Yeah, the kids that go into the National Spelling Bee are wonderful. In fact, there was a documentary film that was just one of the Oscar nominees called Spellbound that I saw that follows the journey of several of these kids to the National Spelling Bee. And they do everything. They learn, they have huge word lists that they work from. And there actually is quite a bit of rote memorizing in what they do. But they also learn about the roots of the words, the Greek and the Latin roots in particular, because that can help them if it's a word that they aren't quite sure about. If they know it's a Greek root, that's going to tell them that, for instance, if they hear a K sound, it might be a CH in the spelling. They learn words that most of us have never even heard of, and spend huge amounts of time studying them. They're kids that are just really interested in everything about words, that, you know, the kind of kid that can sit down and read a dictionary for fun. And it was really interesting to see the film about these kids' stories, about the family support. And it also gets to a point of you're learning so many darn words, it's beyond even the point of being interested in them. They do a huge amount of just memory crunching of big long lists of words.
Another thing is, you know the term phonics?
Yes.
Okay, I talked to a lot of teachers across the country, and they say, I was a kid in school, you know, they didn't sight read, they've learned phonics themselves, they claim. They learned in college, they've been teaching phonics for umpteen years, and they don't know it. They think they know it, but they don't know all of it.
Yeah.
They only know a small precision of it, and because they cannot even read themselves the phonetic chart at the beginning of a dictionary.
Yes, phonics is more complex than people realize, and I think often you hear people say, well, I learned to read by phonics. I think most people in this country learn to read through basal readers, which are the Dick Jane and Sally books are the classic example of the basal reader. Those were usually a mixture of sight words and then some phonics, which is learning about sounds and letters. But actually, it would be pretty hard to learn to read just through phonics and not having the support of reading an entire story as well, because the rules are extremely complex. For instance, most adults, if they were to look at a word that starts with the letter C, and let me make up a nonsense word, C-E-P, most adults would look at that and say something like, well, I think that says SEP, rather than saying, I think that says KEP. But most adults would not be able to say what the rule is for when you pronounce a C like an S, when you pronounce it like a K. I think we, all of us who know how to read, have a lot of phonics knowledge in our heads, but we're not consciously aware of it. We use it unconsciously to figure out words that we don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. I want to get back just real quick to one notion, and that is I really think that a lot of people believe that with an awful lot of things, people, you're either good at it or you're not.
Yes.
That is, you're either born to be able to do it or you're not. And I think that educators would try to say, well, that's really not true. It may indeed be that certain people have inborn abilities for certain things, but it's also the case that different people learn differently, and so the issue is not were you born to be good at this or not, but how can we best teach you and help you to learn that thing? So when it comes to spelling, what do you say if people just say, well, you know, I'm just a bad speller, as if they were born that way?
Right. Well, you know, and part of the issue is, I think, is that spelling is one of the few areas where we expect 100% performance. It's right up there with brain surgery in terms of the standards for it. People who do enough reading to have learned the spelling of a lot of words, even if they don't have a lot of natural spelling ability, as adults, they tend to spell about 95% correctly. And that's, you know, that's really an A performance in anybody's book. But since we're looking for 100%, people often don't achieve that, and then they feel very apologetic about it. It does come a little bit harder to some people, just like anything comes harder to some people than others. I interviewed a seventh grader several years ago who was not a very good speller and really had to work at it. He was a perfectly good reader and writer. He had a very good attitude about it. He said, well, I'm not very good at spelling, but then I'm really good in sports and other kids aren't, so it all evens out. I thought that was very healthy. I think people that it doesn't come as easily to have to work a little harder at it. It's useful to realize that everybody can learn the craft of proofreading. Everybody can learn how to make sure that a job application letter is correctly spelled. And if it doesn't come that easily to you, the strategy may be to find a friend who's a really good speller to proofread it. In fact, I do have a little very informal theory that good spellers and weaker spellers tend to marry each other, so that the weaker speller always has somebody to ask for help. I think it's just one of those things that even if it doesn't come easily to you, you can develop a level of competence at it. Like, for instance, people that aren't very good at math figure out some way to either balance their checkbook or manage their finances so they get by without balancing their checkbook and adapt to it and are able to function. I think in a society that looks for 100% spelling performance, there's ways to adapt to that. And interestingly, many professional writers are not very good spellers, but we don't know that because their publishers have copy editors who are very good spellers and who proofread their manuscripts for them.
Well, every day I say a little prayer of thanks for spell check.
Absolutely.
I'm a terrible speller. I often only half jokingly say that's why I'm a broadcaster, as I'm a bad speller.
Yeah, and I found that my college students now, they use spell check, but they often don't proofread, so often they'll turn in papers with the right spelling of the wrong word.
That is the problem with spell check. If it's a real word, the spell checker will say it's just fine, but
exactly.
If it's not the right word, then that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest this morning, Sandra Wild. She's professor of curriculum and instruction at Portland State University in Oregon and has done a lot of work in the area of spelling, that is, how we learn to spell and how teachers can best help students to learn to spell. This program is an occasional series we've been doing now for some time, looking at various aspects of literacy. We've been doing this with the help of the folks at the National Council of Teachers of English, which is based in Urbana. And by the way, if you're interested in learning more about the organization and you have access to the internet, you can look at their website, which is www.ncte.org. We have some other callers here, and next we'll talk with someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hello. I just thought it was very interesting as I watched my two grandchildren. My granddaughter learned to read on her own at about the age of three.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a prolific reader, a very good speller, and a very good writer. My grandson, who struggled with reading all through, well, I think in some ways, till he was about 9 or 10, yeah, and is a terrible speller. Yeah. He uses the very inventive spelling. I always know what he's going to hope that I will know. But these two in the same family with the same upbringing are just so very, very different. And I thought it was very interesting as I watched them develop this way.
Yes, it really is an individual difference. Do you know how their parents are as spellers?
My daughter is very literate and a very good speller.
Mm-hmm.
And their father is a very cautious and meticulous speller.
Mm-hmm.
But generally does exactly the right thing. He grew up in the English system where at 14 you're out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And she went through university.
Wow.
But she was always a good speller. And I don't know about his early years, but he's very, very capable of writing well, and he's a slow but voracious reader.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I asked is sometimes when children have one parent who's a good speller, one who's a less good speller, the children will be a mixed bag. I think there really may be something genetic to it, just in terms of the general differences in temperament you can see in two children in the same family, that you can have one child whose spelling comes very easily to it and another one who it doesn't.
Well, there's another thing that I noticed. Mary would read books and books and books, and David would say, "Won't you read to me this particular?"
Mm.
He would much rather do that than, and he loved having them read to him.
Yeah, but maybe it just came a little harder to him.
Until he hit subjects that he really wanted to know about, and all of a sudden he could read.
Yeah. Yeah, and probably since he has started reading more, his spelling is better than it would be if he weren't doing the reading. But, you know, I think it's so important that we destigmatize spelling, because often kids who don't spell very well think that they're stupid and that they're incompetent, and it can make them even more reluctant to write.
So this has been my worry. He's just gone through, he's in 7th grade, British equivalent,
mm-hmm,
and he's just gone through an assessment because they felt his spelling was so far below what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he will straighten himself out. He's bright enough. I just hope they don't overemphasize this at the...
Exactly, yeah. And I think we need to say to children, well, look, this is just something that's easier for some people than others, just like all kinds of things. Some kids can run faster than others more easily. Some kids have good vision. Some kids need glasses at a young age. Like, I'm personally really, really nearsighted, and thank goodness for contact lenses. But nobody has ever said to me that it's my fault, that I'm lazy, and that's why I can't see very well. We realize it's just a difference between people, and we don't put a stigma on it. And I think we need to approach spelling the same way.
It bothers me that it's made to be so much to the forefront, and that I think that my grandson has felt sort of shy about doing anything because,
mm-hmm,
he's afraid he will be wrong.
Yeah, and then sometimes you see students not taking as many risks in their writing because they don't use the bigger words because they don't know how to spell them, and
if they spell it wrong,
it'll be a big problem.
Yeah. And I just thought I'd put this contribution in.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Let's go on to another caller. This next person is Urbana in line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I think, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between visual memory and, I guess, what you'd call word memory. When I think, when I hear somebody say cat, I see C-A-T, and somebody else might see a cat there. And I've always wondered about what differences, is there research on differences in visual kind of memory versus word kind of memory?
Yeah, good spelling is very much visual. I think when young children start out, they're phonetic spellers because they haven't seen a lot of words in print, and so all they have to go on is the sounds and then knowing what letters might go with those sounds. And I think when you think about spelling, that's at sort of a different level completely from having like a picture in your head of what the word means, because with spelling, you really have to know what the letters are. There's a sequence of letters.
Mm-hmm.
Good spellers, I think, just are... Do pay more attention to visual detail, and it's not on a conscious level. It's not like, for instance, when I see that misspelled word on the menu, it's not that I'm going over the menu with a fine-tooth comb and trying to see if I can catch them in something. It really just does leap out at me. It's something that I just can't help noticing.
Right.
And not everybody has as much of that. I think everybody does to some extent. But here's an example, for instance. If there's a fairly long word, a lot of us, there are fairly long words that we almost know how to spell but don't have quite right. And often what it is that we have a pretty good visual sense of it from having seen it in print.
I guess I'm wondering, some people, like if you say sky, they see a blue sky.
Mm-hmm.
They see the object, the referent.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, if you say sky, they actually see S-K-Y. Is there any research on that kind of... Obviously, the people who see the words are probably better spellers. I mean, I'm
right.
Sure or not.
Gee, not that I know of. I think in practice, all of us who are literate probably have some combination of that. I don't think people break down into just one or the other. I think it's more a difference of... because we all attend to the meaning of words, of course.
Right.
That's how we communicate. I think it's probably just a question of, well, like for instance, another example, and I confess I am a naturally good speller. If I hear somebody's name and it's an unfamiliar name, maybe from another language, I have a very hard time remembering it until I can see the spelling of it.
Mm-hmm.
Other people can remember it just from the sound. So I think I am very much focused on letters in that way, other people less so.
Is there something like a photographic memory for words that are in print? Is there anything?
Yeah, like somebody who could look at a word once and remember it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. That would be interesting to do a study of some really, really good spellers who never get anything wrong and present them with a list of words. My hunch is... if it did exist, it would probably be very rare.
Yeah. I think
Maybe the same people can learn all their lines for a play after just reading them once.
Yeah. I think some people are able to, like I can, on occasion, I'll be able to see the page. I'll know where a word or a sentence is
mm-hmm.
located on a page that I've, you know, read a while ago or whatever. And it's not a photographic memory, but it's
yeah.
kind of like, or you can see where you had the little doodle next to that sentence or next to that word or whatever.
Right. And are you a good speller?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have guessed that. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I was just wondering if there was something like that, too.
Yeah.
Temple Grandin has written a book called Visual Thinking, and she does, she's autistic, and she
mm-hmm.
she talks about thinking in pictures. And so, again, I was thinking about the difference between thinking in pictures and thinking in words.
Yeah, I haven't read her book, but I know... her story is a very interesting one because she's autistic but quite articulate
right.
and is able to really explain what thinking is like for her.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. I'm sure that we would like, and ideally, I guess, we would like people when they write to spell things correctly the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But if not that, then what we encourage people to do is to proofread,
mm-hmm.
and then look for things that are spelled incorrectly. And someone has coined the term for this spelling conscience. That
mm-hmm.
is, that's something we would like people to try to develop, so that indeed, once they've written something first time, that they'll go back and they'll look at it, and perhaps, as you suggest, if there are things that are spelled incorrectly, that they will jump off the page and
right.
immediately they'll say, oh, I see, this is not right. What exactly does that mean, and how does one develop a spelling conscience?
Well, one of the hardest things to develop in children is the sense of why they should even care about it. I think often they'll say, hey, you can read it, what's the problem? and it is tedious. I think the two things most important to focus on with children, and I'm talking now about children in the upper elementary grades, third through fifth grade or prime years to work on this. The first thing you want to do is get them so they're getting a reasonable number of words correct in the first draft, and I think that is accomplished through having them do a lot of reading, and then also through working on those common words that they miss a lot, like they and girl and first, and every teacher has almost the same list of words that kids miss a lot. However, if you're going to write freely, and you're going to express your ideas, you're going to often be writing words that you don't know how to spell. And so then it's a matter of getting them out quickly in the first draft and going back and proofreading. The first part is developing even an interest in proofreading or caring about it, other than the fact that the teacher wants me to do it. And it's not even a communication issue, because people usually can read it once you're beyond a fairly beginning stage of invented spelling. One thing I think is useful to talk about is just, it's part of what writers do. It's part of taking pride as your work in a writer. When I talk to students as a published author, I tell them, well, I know I could send a manuscript into my publisher that was full of invented spellings and they'd fix it, but I don't do that. I try and send it in really good shape. I try and correct all the spellings, just because it's part of who I am as a writer. I want it to be done really, really well. And I think whatever we can do to develop that sense. And I think there's also the etiquette issue in terms of, particularly as you get older, as you get into high school and beyond, when you're out applying for jobs, when you're out in the work world, people are really fussy about spelling. And so life is going to go better for you if you can do the proofreading, get the spelling corrected. In terms of how you proofread, it's challenging because there's two steps. First, you have to find the words that are spelled wrong. Then you have to fix them. Finding them for young children is not hard because they know that, well, there's all these words I didn't know how to spell, and they're able just to pick them out and say, yeah, I know, I invented that one. For older kids and for adults, it's harder because the word often looks right. It's often very close, or it's the right spelling of a wrong word. So sometimes you may even have to go through slowly, word by word, flag every word that you're a little bit unsure of. And I think spell checkers are very valuable, but you need to have a step beyond the spell checker. And then you need to know, well, how do I find the word in the dictionary if I don't know how to spell it? Again, spell checkers are useful there. It can find words more quickly than you can find them in a dictionary. And then there's the issue of, well, how do I know that I caught them all? And sometimes that's going to involve showing it to somebody else, because even good spellers, your eyes can just skip over a misspelling, particularly if you've read something over and over again. And it's something I think there's a lot of room for instruction, and it's something that a spelling book really can't do, a spelling textbook. It's something that you really need to work with your own writing and just have a lot of practice in doing it.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have a couple of other callers. I'd like to introduce again the guest, Dr. Sandra Wild. She's professor of curriculum and instruction at Portland State University in Oregon and has done a lot of work in this area, that is spelling, how it is that children learn to spell and how teachers can help them learn to spell. And questions are welcome. The next person in line is in Cerro Gordo on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question has to do with a classic rule that was wrong more than it seemed to be right. I before E except after C. as a kid who grew up in the 50s, whenever all the emphasis was on math and science, running across rules that didn't make any sense really used to upset me. Can you give a percentage of how often that rule is wrong, and do you have other favorite rules of spelling that are wrong almost as often as they're right?
Oh, okay, that's a great question. Actually, that's one of the few rules that is correct often enough to be worth teaching. There was a guy named Leonard Wheat who did a study on this in 1932, and he came up with four spelling rules that are worth teaching. That's it, four. The I before E rule is right most of the time if you use the long version of it, which is I before E, except after C, or when sounded like A is in neighbor and way. Okay, if you can remember all that.
It's got to do the full rule.
Yes, exactly. You have to have the full rule or it's not going to work well enough. I think when you use the full version, it's probably correct about 90% of the time. There are a few exceptions, the word weird is an exception. Also, something important to realize about that rule, for it to work, you have to know that the word, that it's either I-E or E-I. For instance, the word friend, a young child would spell just with the letter E because you just hear a short E sound. But if you know the word friend is either I-E or E-I, then the rule will work. Then it will help you. The other three rules that Leonard Wheat had just have to do with changing root words before a suffix, about dropping the E, like when you change come to coming, you drop the E, about doubling the consonant, when you change hop to hopped, you double the P, and then about changing Y to I, when you go fry to fried, you change the Y to I. The spelling books look like they have a lot of rules, but most of them are really just descriptions of patterns, like a spelling book might have in one of their lessons. The long E sound is often spelled E-A or double E or E-I, but then it won't tell you how to know which of those spellings applies in a particular word, just because there isn't any way to know. You have to just know the word. There are a couple other rules that work some of the time. Like, for instance, A-Y for the sound A is more likely to occur at the ends of words like play and day and stay, and then A-I in the middle of words like rain and plain. Here's a good one for adults that does work that most people have never been taught. Do you often get confused about whether a word ends with A-B-L-E or I-B-L-E?
Yes.
Okay. Nobody knows. You have to just know the word, people think. But it actually has to do with what the root word is. For instance, the word livable is A-B-L-E, but the word visible is I-B-L-E. The reason is that livable has a word that you can sort of see right there as the root. You basically take live and add the ending, and then you have to drop the E, of course, because that's spelling rule. But visible doesn't come from a word vis. And so if you think of words like likable, agreeable, words like that, you can always see the root word right there, and then it's A-B-L-E, whereas words like legible, well, it doesn't have leg as the root word, so it's I-B-L-E. That one actually works most of the time.
One more quick rule question.
Mm-hmm.
Vowels, sometimes Y and sometimes W. Can you give an example of a word where a W is a vowel?
Oh, yeah. It's the word bow, B-O-W. The W, or actually, let me think of a better example. The word brow is a better example there. That the O and the W together make the ow sound. And so the W is technically considered part of the vowel spelling. Whereas in the word wing, it makes a consonant sound at the beginning of the word. So it's never a vowel by itself, but usually with an O, it spells a vowel sound.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll get at least one more here, and this caller is in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I got asking about the relationship between various inherited factors and your ability to spell. And the first one of these is there any relationship between a person's natural ability for the mathematics and sciences as compared with a liberal arts and a fine arts person?
Boy, yeah, I think that's a hard one to answer because there's so many things go into something like that. I think certainly some people do have more math ability than others. They might tend to go into a mathematical field because of that. But I think there'd be so many other issues of temperament and stuff. And I don't think there any of the stuff we can say that there's a single gene that does this. I think with the spelling, I think we can say descriptively that it just does seem to come more easily to some people than others. Mm-hmm. And it does appear to be probably inborn.
Okay, thank you. And the other one is, how about what I would call a discriminating ear? A person who can hear words pronounced correctly, but they might not be able to, I mean, they are not able to discriminate between the words. As myself, I grew up in the Southwest, and I originally had time, troubles spelling the word, and I spelled it W-A-R-S-H, because
okay.
I essentially heard it being said, wash.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So I have an ear which does not discriminate between these various sounds.
Yeah, and you know what? It's actually not that you don't have an ear that doesn't discriminate. You just grew up in a region where people pronounce things one way and people in another part of the country pronounce them a different way.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so nothing wrong with you. It's just a regional variation. And young children tend to spell words the way they pronounce them, and then as they get older, they have to learn, well, it's not always spelled the way it's pronounced. And sometimes that's going to reflect the way that people speak in their part of the country. For instance, many parts of the South, the words that I pronounce pen and pin, P-E-N and P-I-N, people will pronounce them both about the same,
yeah.
Pin. In Oregon, where I live, the proper names D-A-W-N and D-O-N, people pronounce the same. They pronounce them Don. I grew up in New Jersey, and I'm going to exaggerate a little, but I grew up pronouncing them Dawn and Don.
Uh-huh.
People in Oregon, young children in Oregon, are going to be likely to spell those names the same. Young kids on the East Coast are going to be more likely to spell them differently. Not that they hear them differently, they actually pronounce them differently, and people around them do.
Okay.
Do too.
Okay, thank you very much, ma'am.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, you know, I think that we have about used our time, and we have a couple of callers, and will have to apologize to them and say I don't really think that we have time to take the call. I did want to ask you a question, and we don't really have time for you to give a complete answer,
mm-hmm.
But, you know, there has for a number of years now been a lot of controversy involving whole language and phonics, and
yes.
Which is the right way to teach reading, and the whole business of caught up in this is also the question about the way to teach spelling,
mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of controversy about invented spelling.
Mm-hmm.
Is there enough of a movement against that so that we're talking about going back to the older ways that we have taught spelling with workbooks and word lists and people saying no, invented spelling is wrong and we should not, even from the very start, we shouldn't be doing that?
I think there is some pressure to go back in that direction. I think a number of states are including spelling tests in the state testing that they're doing, which makes teachers feel pressure to go back to word lists. I think that's a shame because we really do all have the same goal, which is to have kids pretty much by the end of elementary school be able to produce a piece of writing that's correctly spelled. I think what makes the most sense is just to work with kids in a common sense way, have them do a lot of reading, have them focus on proofreading their spelling when they write, learning how to spell those common words, have it be something that's really enmeshed in the whole literacy process, not just something that you do 15 minutes a day.
Mm. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest, Dr. Sandra Wild, she's professor of curriculum and instruction at Portland State University in Oregon. Also, our thanks to the folks at the National Council of Teachers of English in Urbana for setting up the program for us.